Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. One in four students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network, and I am joined by Tracy Pearson, Friday, January 19th, 10:39 a.m. Tracy, how are you doing?
I'm 10:40. I'm always ahead of you, Dave.
I'm now 10:40.
So I do want to talk about something. Your best friend and buddy, Seth Davis.
Oh, yeah.
He was at the game at Pauley on Sunday. He generally says hello to me. I was wearing my Dave Woods t-shirt and he still said hello.
That's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, just give our people just a little bit of a background of your history with Mr. Davis.
I really don't like Seth Davis. Bordering on personally. He's a smarmy, talentless hack.
Wait, Dave, come on, man, give it to us straight.
Yeah, he has no real ability, and he went to Duke, so already, you know, that's a shot against him. He spends most of his time in the media just saying smarmy things. Whenever the subject comes up of UCLA, though, there's a real element of you know, kind of conceited anger about the whole thing. He doesn't like UCLA, and that's been a prevalent part of his worldview and writing and journalistic arc. I've gotten blocked by Seth on two different accounts, the Bruin Report Online account in, I think, 2013, and then my own account last year when I went at him for his mother being a charlatan who promotes bunk cancer cures. He is a smarmy person.
I should
person.
Not laugh.
He's
this,
a smarmy person, and he's...
I just looked up smarmy in the dictionary.
Yeah, it's Seth.
In his picture.
Yeah, he's a bad person, and he clearly comes from a line of bad people.
So, oh, damn.
So,
bad and personal. He showed up. I think I've seen him at Pauley one other time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he showed up Sunday.
Yeah, he has not been to a UCLA home game under Mick Cronin, and then decided to show up when they were 6-10 going into Washington.
And he lives locally.
He lives in Southern California.
Yeah, yeah.
So
anyway, I just wanted
backstory.
To start it off with that kind.
Yeah. He wrote a story about Cronin and the program and all that kind of stuff. There's some valid stuff in there, then a lot of mealy-mouthed crap.
I didn't even get to it. Was it pretty critical?
Pretty critical. I mean, it's mostly in the underhanded things he says, like the way he shades things. It's just
that passive aggressive kind of thing.
Yes. So anyway, it was pretty critical of Cronin, pretty critical of UCLA's NIL situation, which again, we've talked about, probably in the top 25 range, not in the top 5 range. So anywho.
I just thought we'd start. I think UCLA fans have a lot of pent-up aggression, anger, resentment, frustration right now. So I just wanted to start it with that, just so that there's kind of a, you know, a target, a little bit of a, you know, that you can channel all of that toward.
Yeah.
I think they're going to be some bros going after him now.
That's right. So, it
pick
is
up the mantle that Dave had to drop.
Yeah.
Carry Dave's mantle.
Yeah. Carry my shield and my sword. Anyway, UCLA basketball is riding a 2-game win streak, playing better basketball of late. And by of late, I mean in the last 5 days, after getting shellacked by Utah. And I guess, Tracy, my main takeaway here is we really inspired them with our podcast on Friday last week.
I love how you think anyone at UCLA paid attention to that thing.
I think everyone said, wow, wow. You know, what they said, it's really galvanizing. It's really important. It nailed everything.
Yeah, Mick sent me his notes.
I bet. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. He probably sent you thank you. I took notes and decided that this was obviously the way to go.
Yeah, way too much credit. But okay,
yeah.
I'll go with it.
So anyway, UCLA beat Washington on Sunday. It was probably their pretty close to their best played game of the year, I would say. Great defensive first half, and then the second half, the offense got going. Defense wasn't quite as good, but it was a more or less complete game. And then
they actually beat a team that I think was better than they are.
Yeah. I would say much worse coached, but
But just from a talent standpoint, who you just put out on the court?
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah.
And it was an impressive showing. And then
talent and experience. Sorry,
had to. But throw then that in. Tracy. We got to witness one of the funniest games I've ever seen on Wednesday night. UCLA went to Tempe, and it looked like a return of the Bad News Bruins from a month ago. They were down, I think it was 36-23 at the half. ASU was hitting a very high percentage from three. There was one missed blockout where one of the ASU guards got an offensive rebound when there were literally four Bruins standing around the key just
watching.
Wow.
I tweeted that. That one killed me.
It was just, it looked low effort.
It was Frankie Collins, who's what, six foot?
Two?
He just, yeah. He just sliced his way. It looked like he crawled through someone's legs to get it.
Yeah. And it looked like the same kind of low effort, low energy stuff that we saw against Utah. Wouldn't have been surprising if they got blown out in the second half. Yada, yada, yada.
Okay. Sorry. I just wanted to add a game where they seriously beat someone that you put on the court were more talented and experienced.
Totally. But that it was that first half just brutal. Another brutal half where we're all like, what are we doing? Why are we watching this? What's going on?
Isn't it funny how you go back and forth after Washington? You gear your mind up that there's going to be some improvement. They're going to play better. And then after the half, it all starts flooding back into your brain.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You just say, oh, my God, we're right back. We got to watch this crap. Blah, 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 blah. You and I are texting each other basically saying, why do we have to watch this?
Yeah. One of my comments was just unpleasant. So that was the first half. Then the second half, and here's what I want to say, because I think a lot of people are focusing on the technical fouls, which is very funny, and they were very important, but also very funny. UCLA was putting together a little punk comeback even before those started. And in fact, I would say the comeback is what put a little bit of pressure on ASU to start doing a lot of very dumb, very Bobby Hurley things. Because UCLA had cut it to 49-43 with about 13 to go off a Sebastian Mack drive and dish to Berke Buyuktunjil for a layup. And then the fireworks started. Because on the next trip down, Lazar Stefanovic gets hammered across the face. And, okay, a lot of the conversation about this has been that shouldn't have been a flagrant. That's incidental. When playing basketball, have you ever braced your arm on another player's face? Like, when has that ever happened? Because it doesn't happen.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the ASU fans actually did admit I think they said three of them were valid. There might have been.
Well, that was the flagrant. That was the flagrant, not the
technical. Yeah, I mean all the technicals.
Yeah. So then the technicals happened when he falls down. That eventually gets assessed as a flagrant. But then the big guy, his name's escaping me at the moment, for ASU, gets into it with Adem Bona, and they'd been getting into it all night, where Adem Bona was clearly egging him on a little bit, like giving him a big smile and, you know, that sort of stuff. And this guy, Sean Phillips, that's his name, was very intense. He gets a technical for arguing with Bona. Bona gets one as well. And then Tony Padilla, who's a very bad referee, I watched the clip, and it's Phillips says something, but it's not like aggressively said. It might be a, you know, go F yourself or something like that. It might be something like that, but it was casual, and he wasn't looking at Padilla when he said it. So it could have been to anybody. It could have been about anything. Padilla is clearly in his feelings by this point, and he ejects Phillips for his second technical. So UCLA ends up shooting four free throws and gets the ball back and shoots a three off that. So they go from going into that possession down 6 points to up a point coming out of it. Full marks. Loved it. Every second of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, watching that game, you know, when it comes to officiating, you want to step back and say, okay, try to take your bias away and those were legit calls. Maybe the only one was the ASU fans are saying the one against Neil, that was kind of a retaliatory one and where he was talking. But, you know, I'm sorry. So many times the call is, you know, the guy, it's not the guy who says it first, it's the guy who responds. So they were all legit. I don't think ASU fans really had a leg to stand on if they're saying the officiating was bad, because they all looked legit. Where should ASU fans focus their resentment?
Well, Bobby Hurley has made a team in his own image. Like, they are, this is the quintessential.
You embody your coach, right?
This is the quintessential Bobby Hurley team. And it's just, that he's finally got a team full of guys who behave like he does. He's not just intense on the sideline, he's behaving like a madman on the sideline, and his team does that. And so throughout this game, like, I would say the Neil one, again, he said something to the ref like immediately afterwards. I would say the Phillips second tech would probably be the one I would have taken back if I was the ref, because you just teed him up, he's heated, and then you should just, you know, put on your hidden earmuffs right then and just walk away. You don't eject college players from a college game unless they do something horrible.
Yeah, unless they physically assault
you. Yeah, and he wasn't doing that. He was just talking. Let him go cool down for a second and then come back at him if he keeps doing it. But that was the only one I had a problem with. Everyone else, I mean, it's like, stop talking. Like, how are you at this point in the game? Maybe they do not like your team. Maybe they don't like your coach. How are you still talking to the refs at that point?
And we put up a little snippet of Bobby Hurley's post-game press conference. That did not do it justice.
No, he was beautiful.
No, you need to go watch the whole thing. I'm not going to say anything about it, but it is entertainment value. Very, very much.
The way and manner he speaks is just, it's something else. Go watch. But he's an intense fella. It's a little bit like the Sean Miller, he touched the ball thing.
Isn't that Duke too? Isn't Duke?
Yeah, he's another Dukey.
Yeah, Duke. We got a Duke theme going on.
Yeah,
here.
We've got a Duke theme, Dukey. So UCLA won both of those games. The ASU game, they had to kind of mount successive comebacks, and it was aided by the technicals, but they showed a lot of mental toughness to kind of keep going. Sebastian Mack, you wrote a great thing about Mack and you know, his potential progression and what he provides for this team right now. But I mean, the main takeaway is that was still a hard game to win, even with the technicals, and they were able to win it despite very raucous crowd, hostile road environment. that's the kind of game that I've seen UCLA teams lose even when they are getting advantages. And to do that, I think, took some growth from this team from where it was a month ago, for sure. And even where it was at the beginning of the season, because they lost a lot of games where they had second half leads in November, as we saw.
Yeah. You know, I might be a little bit of a damper here. They are playing better. But those two games could have gone either way. I mean, especially the SU game. They were losing almost the entire game. We all feel better because they got a win. But I'm not prepared to say they're playing a lot better. The one thing there are a few elements that they are doing better. We were on, you know, the soapbox for the first 10 games that you just can't get Adembona to catch the ball 15 feet from the basket. He look to score. I mean, he can catch it and hand it off and set a screen, but he can't go from the elbow to the basket. That's problematic. He's not doing that anymore. So he is setting up on the block. So that's one. Two, they're feeding him the ball, which, you know, they didn't before because a lot of times he wasn't on the block, but he is now. Darren Savino is the post coach. And you can say, well, he didn't have a Dem prepared to start the season, even though he was kind of used as a face up four. But now what he's done with him, that he slowed him down, catches the ball. And let's just say Adembona does not have great hands.
Ooh.
Catches the ball, generally holds onto it, takes his time, is looking for the double team, and is timing his passes out of the double team so much better. Recognizing when he does have space to try to score, so much better. I think that's the number one development. And I think that has settled down this team offensively. It needed something offensively. And I think now Mick Cronin, I know you don't agree with this, but Mick Cronin said, you need the offense to go through someone. And that's how this offense is designed. And now it's doing that. So that's the biggest development. I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not thinking this is a big turnaround. They're miraculously going to play Arizona competitively. But that's a big development right there, that they are, how they're using Bona offensively and how he's developed in, how many games are we in?
18.
So that's my biggest takeaway to what I've seen in the last two games. Inadvertently, like I wrote in the Sebastian Mack piece, when he and Lazar Stefanovic are rested, they play much better. I don't think Mick Cronin said he sat him. He didn't start Mack in the second half because he just needed him to calm down, which really helped him. And he had a great half, just a spectacular half. And like in that story, if you put together his two second halves of the last two games, that is a phenomenal player right there. Complete with heads up assists where he's driving and feeding people. And I still believe, even in 2 years when Sebastian Mack is probably shooting threes at a 38% clip and he's actually jump stopping, and he's driving the basket under control with intention, I'm still going to say I bet his best aspect of his game is going to be passing. He has shown he can really pass. And I just would like him to do it more. And in the second halves of the last two games, he has like five assists in those two halves. So that's my second biggest. I'd really like to see him him pass the ball more. But the overarching one is those guys play better when they're well, when they're well rested.
Yeah. I think the main takeaway from the first game against Washington, my takeaway at any rate, was that the first half was probably the best half of basketball UCLA's played this year. And it came with Sebastian Mack playing 2 minutes. I think he saved them at the end of the ASU game, but I think that's still playing with fire in a lot of ways, because it's just, does the ball go in or not? He had 2 assists in against ASU, and you know, one of them was that nice one to Buyuktunjil for the layup in the midst of that comeback. But I mean, for the most part, what he was doing was driving the lane and taking a tough shot and trying to get fouled, which is a lot of what we saw in November with Mack. And he made them in this one, but they were tough shots. So I think he can grow into a player, but I think this is, if I had a concern coming out of this, because I do think UCLA is playing better and I do think the ball movement is generally better, but I think that's largely from Adembona first not being against ASU. And this is so funny because Mick clearly had this game planned from like watching film, because he knew that ASU likes to double down from the wing instead of doubling from behind, which the double, if you've been watching all year, the double from behind is what Bona's struggled with. You know, when he pivots into a guy immediately and gets stripped, ASU apparently doesn't game plan and they just do what they do. So they double from the wing and that leaves an open shooter. But in this game, Bona was actually, you know, he's showing some vision in a way that he hasn't.
And he was coached.
Yeah, clearly
they're going to come at you from the wing. Just kick it back out to the guy who's right. Set up.
And so that led to, I think, 2 open threes and then one that Stefanovic absolutely should have pulled the trigger on that he dribbled into the key for a turnover. But I think the improved passing is largely from, and I mean, this is, and this is like where you, I really don't envy Mick Cronin the task he has in front of him. It's a better passing team when Mack's off the floor because he doesn't generally look to pass. I agree with you that he has passing ability, but he
doesn't. When he looks to pass, he's one of the best passers on the team. But you're right. They pass better because most of the time he's not looking to pass.
Because they're moving the ball. You know, there's something to be said. Like, David Singleton drew a lot of consternation before his, like, very good, I don't know, final year and a half, 2 years. Because he didn't make, like, incisive passes, and he wasn't, like, doing anything that hard, and people would, like, denigrate his turnover rate for that. But there's something to be said for just reliably moving the ball and not letting it stick in your hands. Will McClendon is one of those. He moves the ball around. It's not, you know, he's not always, like, making a beautiful pass for a bounce pass for a layup or whatever, but he's moving the ball around and keeping guys involved so they're not just standing around. Drawing no attention from the defense. If you move the ball around against the college defense long enough, especially one that's as poorly coached as Washington or ASU, you're going to find some openings. Like, you will, eventually, because the guys get lazy or inattentive. And so if you're Sebastian Mack, a lot of times what you're looking for is an opening to drive, but if you don't pass the ball, there's rarely an opening to drive, yada, yada, yada. So I guess my larger point is, they've been moving the ball a lot better at different times, and I think it's, to your point, part of it is Sebastian Mack being well-rested in the second half, so he's playing better, but also of it, he's not playing as many minutes, so there's more minutes for good ball movement.
All of that, yes. If there's one other thing that's frustrating me watching, well, there's a lot of things frustrating me when I watch them on the offensive side of the court. I mean, they can't shoot. They're not a good shooting team.
But suddenly, you know, they're shooting better because they're moving the ball better.
And they're getting better looks. But tell me, on the simple ball screen, the simple pick and roll, mm-hmm. So the screener sets the screen, then he just rolls to the basket. There are so many times where that screener is open.
Yep.
And watch the guard. He doesn't even look.
They don't look.
Wow, they don't look. Tiger Camp, I mean, how many alley-oops? Just first off, how many times this season has the screener caught the ball off a pick and roll?
You could probably count it on 2 hands.
Maybe 1 hand. How many alley-oops off that? I think 1?
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. Tiger Campbell knew how to do that. that was like one of the, you know, college basketball, so much of the offense is just a pick and roll offense. And he knew how to do that. That's the first thing. I mean, in my universe, pick and roll, you're not doing it to free yourself. The first thing is to get that guy rolling close to the basket where he can catch it and get a high percentage shot. They're not even looking for it. That's the most frustrating thing for me now. And if you didn't notice it, now you're going to watch a game, you're going to notice, and you're going to hate me because I just pointed that out if you hadn't noticed it. If you have noticed it, you're already pulling your hair out.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, I mean, I think it goes back to the main issue that we've had. Like, if you're, like, there's lots of, like, underlying things. Like, the two-post system is gone. We obviously had a problem with that. And, or the two-center system, I should say. They're still kind of doing some two-post stuff with Burke. But point guard play has not been a strength. I don't think we're breaking any new ground there. Dylan Andrews, even against ASU, clear and significant confidence issues. And even you can even see it when he's initiating the offense, like just a lack of decisiveness, a lack of, you know, I'm just going to do the thing that needs to be done here. And even he's got a great first step. He can dribble the ball, but he's not beating guys off the dribble. And that's just confidence, indecision, yada, 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 all of it. It's infected his shooting. Thankfully, it hasn't infected his defense, but it's still an issue. And I think again, if you're looking for encouraging things, the past two games didn't really come with improved play from the point guard position. And to be able to do that against these two teams, to be able to come back against the team when your point guard really isn't playing that well, I mean, it speaks to a lot of, I mean, first, again, a lot of stupidity of ASU, but they were making the comeback even before that. And I think it was interesting that, what was it, the last 10 minutes or so that Sebastian Mack was on the ball, basically the entire back half of the second half against ASU.
Yeah, like that last 10 minutes.
Yeah, because even with Mack's, and Mick isn't blind. He sees, like, okay, Mack is he's just going to dribble into the teeth of the defense and hope to make something happen. But that's still, given what Andrews was giving them, that's still probably a superior bet in those crunch time moments, especially if, to your point, you've got a well-rested Mack.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
On May 23rd.
I want to go back to normal.
What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil, returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd. Only on Paramount Plus.
Yeah. I think your point a bit is, at least also saying, there's so much room for improvement. They actually won these two games without great point guard play.
Yeah, if Dylan Andrews gets it together, this team can make some real improvement. I don't...
Yeah.
Look, get it out of your heads that they're going to even have a chance against Arizona tomorrow, because that one could be an ugly blowout. Maybe it won't be, but it could be. So just keep that in mind.
I actually thought Dylan Andrews played one of his better games, if not maybe his best overall, against Washington. He had 8 assists. He actually passed the ball well. He shot it for crap, but I don't care. They had, what, that was the game where they had 20 assists on 25 made baskets. And
yeah,
he had
8. So against Washington,
if he's passing the ball, he played a lot better. So, you know, as we know, improvement is not a straight line. So in the last two games, he has played a little. He has played better in the Washington game.
Yeah. So ASU was not good.
Yeah.
So the situation right now is they've. I won't say they've righted the ship. They're all up. All glad tidings from here. They still did lose by 46 a week ago. But this is certainly not a result that people were expecting. I think people were expecting them to lose both of these past two games. They didn't. It looks like they're going to avoid the true abject disaster season, because there are still, you know, there's still games on this schedule where even if they play more or less like they did in December, that are probable wins, like Oregon State at home in a couple of weeks, perhaps, you know, USC at home, you know, ASU at home at the end of the year. So it's not going to be the like absolute nightmare. You know, they finish 8-23 and we're all, you know, devastated. It'll be better than that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk after tomorrow. After
Arizona's going to be bad. Everyone gird your loins. It's not going to be fun. Not going to be pleasant.
I want to look. What is girding loins?
I don't know. Probably.
What is that process?
Probably like put some stabilization down there.
I'm looking what do we think? Right now.
Gird your loins.
Gird loins.
What does it mean to gird up my loins?
There's diagrams.
Okay, it originally alluded to tucking up the traditional long robe into a girdle so it will not hamper physical activity.
Yeah. I got a little guy like in a toga who's kind of,
Okay, so you got to gird your loins. You got to take your trailing robe and tuck it around your waist.
Got it. Wow, learn something new today, Dave. And you use that term and you didn't even know what it meant, right?
Who knows?
Yeah.
No one knows.
Gird your loins. It sounds nasty.
It does. Okay. That's basketball. Football.
Yes.
Shall we turn our attention?
Yeah, yeah.
Football has picked up. So here's where I want to start. UCLA has addressed its positional needs in the transfer portal. They have attacked two positions that I think we both identified as major issues, and they have gotten bodies to fill those roles. They have
what two positions?
Safety and edge rush. They have gotten bodies to fill those roles.
Okay. So got it.
However, so first, I think everyone needs to like understand. So Ramon Henderson, that's a one-year guy who was a four-star cornerback out of high school, didn't end up starting at Notre Dame, probably going to be, I would guess he probably ends up starting at UCLA just because of lack of bodies.
I think.
Brian Addison, we're hearing they're optimistic that he'll be eligible for this year. It's not a done deal yet, but optimistic.
From what I hear, there were a couple of different things he had to get past. One was more difficult. One was a little bit easier. He's gotten past the more difficult one.
Yeah. So we'll see where that ends up, but looking good right now. He would probably be the starter at the other safety spot. If you go look at his Oregon history, he really didn't spend a whole lot of time on defense. It's really just been, I think, the last year and change. He was a receiver before that. But, again, probably think he starts at safety. And then KJ Wallace, the Georgia Tech transfer, played a lot of nickel for Georgia Tech.
And there are your starting Bruins in the secondary.
That's your starting safety secondary, including the nickel.
So be very interesting. You know, when you have a transfer or a new player and you have, you know, like the safeties are three and you throw in the corner, so that's a five-man unit that you have as a secondary. You add one or two new guys as starters or guys who play the majority of the minutes. When you add three guys at safety, and even if they're fairly talented, there's, you know, you got to know what you're doing. Yep. So there's going to be a big... You got to just consider there's a learning curve with these guys. You know, it's funny, too. I just want to say about Brian Addison. When he was in high school, I think I was like 25 years old because it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I saw him at various camps. He was one of the most dominant wide receivers.
Did you write about that on a typewriter?
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, the ribbon kept coming off.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was.
Did you call it in to a stenographer? Did you?
I got the little press little thing in my hat.
Yeah,
the little press. Yeah.
When you interviewed him afterwards, did you actually use a physical tape recorder that had to be like changed, like the tapes?
No, I just wrote my hand notes.
Oh, right.
We didn't have tape recorders, Dave.
Correct.
Do you remember watching him as the defensive back at Oregon? And is there any recollection of him playing?
I watched him a little bit last year, but nothing stood out.
I'm really curious to see him because I don't remember watching him play at Oregon as a defensive back.
He never struck me as the right size, but fine. Like, he's like 6'5".
He is a legit 6'5".
He's tall. That's tall to play DB.
Yeah.
Any DB position.
Yeah. He's a big question mark to me.
But
Ramon Henderson and KJ Wallace. KJ Wallace was the starting nickel at Georgia Tech. Ramon Henderson, first guy off the bench, played a good number of snaps over the course of, you know, a few years. And from what I've heard, talked to some people in Notre Dame, they considered him a talented and very athletic guy. They just said he was really raw and he just needed more time and he got passed over.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those two guys, though, have experience, have played. I'm really curious to see a 6'5 safety.
Yeah.
That doesn't kind of fit. But, I mean, if he's good, it's kind of fun to think about a 6'5 safety.
Yeah, it is fun to think about. My main takeaway is that I think none of those three guys are going to – I don't think any of them are going to be that – I don't think they're going to be bad. I don't think they're going to make you forget Kamari Ramsey, Kenny Churchwell, and Alex Johnson from this past year.
That was seriously one of the best safety groups in a long time.
Yeah, it was pretty darn good. So I think it'll be a step back, but – I think
Alex Johnson was really good.
Right. But I think the thought that it was going to be a disaster, I think you can probably put that out of mind as far as the safety position, because they now have, and this is, again, assuming Addison gets eligible, they have three guys who've played a decent amount of college football and, you know, at the FBS level. So there's that. Then at edge rush, you have Collins Achiampong. Going with that?
Sure.
And Jacob Busich, the Navy defensive end. Now, these are, again, two bodies to replace, a lot more than two, but to replace, ostensibly, Leatu Latu and Gabriel Murphy or Grayson Murphy or Carl Jones or whatever. They need more. They need more bodies, but two is, you know, kind of the bare minimum that we were looking at coming out of the season. The problem is neither of those guys, like, they're both, I mean, Collins has a lot of upside, but they're both from a production level like what you would expect like Jake Heimlicher to be. And this is the part where I think expectations for the defense are really difficult to hammer out, because their pass rush is not going to be anywhere close to what it was.
Busich is Heimlicher.
Right.
Let's just say that.
And Collins is some guy who didn't exist, but a high upside player.
Yes. You know, there's also Joseph Vaughn, the...
who could play edge rush too, right.
Who might, actually, yeah. That might be where he needs a plug in.
Yeah, and that replaces, let's say, Carl Jones? I don't know. Anybody? Yeah. It doesn't really replace anybody they had.
What we're saying is they got some bodies.
Yes.
So they'll be able to put some guys on the field. And they might be solid.
They're not going to be tripping on their shoelaces.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking. Remember we used to say Ryan Walcott.
Yeah. And like,
where is Ryan Walcott? Okay, you talk. I'm searching Ryan Walcott.
No, but that was the main thing I was thinking of when I was talking about these guys. It's like the Ryan Walcott situation where it's like, look, if you're expecting when these guys are out there that they're going to like trip over their own shoelaces and it's going to be a circus of disaster, no, that's not what it's going to be. But you're not going to get the high upside plays. You're not going to get the high-end plays that you got from Gabriel Murphy, Leatu Latu, Grayson Murphy, Carl Jones, yada, 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 and on and on and on. They will have bodies to fill the positions. And look, I think that was what UCLA was capable of doing this cycle. There's obviously a lot of NIL issues for UCLA football. And more, it seems like the recruiting game is becoming largely about NIL. And so what they ended up with in large part is guys who have a prior existing relationship with the staff, or they are California bounce backs, or both. And, you know, some of these guys have some real ability. You know, getting Rico Flores at wide receiver, he's got some real talent. I think Ramon Henderson, like you were saying, he's got upside. It's just 1 year that they get of him, but he's got some upside. And Collins, obviously, he's another bounce back who has tremendous amount of upside. But you're not getting... There's no Zach Charbonnet. There's no Leatu Latu. There's no Gabriel or Grayson Murphy in this crew. And until UCLA gets its NIL figured out, which will probably be under a new regime in the future, it's probably the way it's going to be.
Yes.
So, not to be like 200
down. Ryan Walcott recently was an assistant coach for the Yavapai College women's basketball team.
Heck yeah, Ryan.
2022, but he's not on the staff right now. So I don't know what happened to him. If anyone knows where Ryan Walcott is,
we want to know.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, Ryan Walcott came to UCLA. He's a Bruin. He tried his hardest, did his best. So yeah, I feel a little bad we use his name like that. But yeah, so it's been, I didn't listen too much to what you just said because I was doing a deep dive on Ryan Walcott. But what they have done in the transfer portal, I mean, like you said, they went out and covered some needs. When you say needs, though, that kind of means that they're replacing
production. They've covered roster spots.
They covered roster spots.
Yeah.
There's a lot to this roster that is yet to be completed. We still have a transfer portal window that will open at the end of April. That's made for players who, the intention is that they go to their spring practice and then it gives them the option to transfer after their spring practice. UCLA commonly isn't done with their spring practice by the time that portal opens. They have at least another... It usually ends about the 25th.
Yeah.
And then the portal goes the 15th to the 30th.
Yep.
So that'll be interesting. Like I said on the forum, there were some guys that we were hearing were either going to put their names in the NFL draft or were thinking of transferring, and many did not. We have identified a few of them. J. Michael Sturdivant, Kane Medrano, Jay Toia. But in this, so everyone feels good that, hey, they didn't go in the NFL draft. They didn't transfer. And that is a good first step. It is. And I'm just saying it's not over. I'm not saying that all three of those guys will transfer. I think there's a good likelihood they stay at UCLA, but in this environment, when you would think Jay Toia would be worth a good amount of NIL money.
Yeah.
Kane Medrano probably could get a little bit of NIL money. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
J. Michael Sturdivant, you know, maybe he double dips. He's an interesting situation. I mean, he's already getting a good amount at UCLA. He could easily go shop himself to see if he can get more. But then there's the element, since he's already transferred, first, is he a graduate, which I don't think he is. And then secondly, we still haven't gotten a pure definition on that rule where you can transfer if you're an undergrad for a second time.
Yeah.
So I would think, well, I know there's just still a lot to work out. And that's just those guys. There could be other guys who decide to also transfer from this roster. And then UCLA will be going into the transfer portal.
Yes.
Now, we have seen the level of guys they're getting. And we're not disparaging. But none of these transfers cost NIL money. I mean, if they are getting some NIL, they're getting a real base amount and maybe enough for their parents to fly out and see them play. That's about it. You can probably expect the same level of level of player for UCLA to be able to get in spring. In other words, I don't see UCLA suddenly coming to the table with a lot of NIL money for the spring transfer portal when it opens up. So that brings us around full circle to, how did you say they're not meeting their needs, but they are filling roster spots.
Yeah, they're filling their roster spots.
Now they randomly might. UCLA has it is a transfer destination. There can be guys who want to bounce back. Maybe they get a well sought after transfer who just wants to come home, but in spring practice, most of the time, the guys who transfer, as we all know, are the guys who came away from spring practice and said, wow, I'm not getting playing time.
Yeah.
Those aren't the guys who usually are going to be big impact players.
No.
So all in all, there's a lot to happen. UCLA could lose some guys, and then the quality of guys they could get in spring, I'm not predicting everyone. You know, there could be a randomly very talented player who could come in and be an instant starter, but it's just logical sense to come to the conclusion that there might not be a lot of talent available in the spring transfer portal for UCLA. The other element are these programs that have lost their coaches.
Yeah.
So Alabama, how many guys are transferring out of that?
Oh, it's like 30, I think, already.
So that's where you think there might be some talent for UCLA to go get. Have we heard of UCLA involved with any Alabama guy in the transfer portal?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that we're aware of. If it's out there, we haven't heard it. Mostly because those guys were all 4 or 5-star guys and they want some NIL money.
Yep.
There's Washington and Arizona.
Yeah, and Keanu Wilhite, who got out of his
but he's not a transfer. We'll talk. I just want to say, what's his name? He's got the best name, Ephesians Prysock.
Yeah,
the Arizona cornerback who made a big impact in Arizona's game with UCLA. He was all over the field. He goes in the transfer portal and. I know we all, we all do it. Wow, I hope UCLA could get involved. Very, very little chance that guy's going to get some NIL money.
Yep.
And UCLA can't compete. So between Washington and Arizona, there are some guys out there, but so far we haven't really heard that UCLA could be involved. And just to clarify, they're able to go in the transfer portal and transfer because there was a change at their head coaching.
Yep.
Spot. So it just needed all of that explained and defined.
I appreciate that about you.
So what do you think, Dave?
What do I think about what?
What do you think about the situation with UCLA's transfer portal situation? The situation with the situation.
I think UCLA is going to have to do some... I think they've already done it and they've come up that they don't have one, but doing some soul searching about what they want to do regarding their football program is probably the main thing, because UCLA won't be competitive in the transfer portal market. The transfer portal market is becoming even more dominated by NIL money than the high school market is now. High school market's pretty dominated, but it's mostly at that top tier. The transfer market, it's if you're at all a quality transfer or... you are a transfer at a position of need. You're getting some money. And UCLA has to present other factors beyond that to even get guys' attention. Most of the time, it's geographical location. So there's that. I think the obvious response to this is zigging again when people are zagging, is to de-emphasize the transfer portal as part of your roster makeup, as we've been recommending from the beginning, and instead go back to high school recruiting, where you're probably going to be able to carve out a niche and get higher level of talent for less NIL money. And if you are running a good program, as Chip Kelly was up until this past year, I mean, they really hadn't had a lot of transfers out. you probably won't have that many transfer outs if you recruit locally and prioritize high school recruiting. Because generally, the guys who leave the program are from where? Not here. Not here. So.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, most of it, but I think the whole situation is problematic. I advocate development. You recruit high school players, you bring them in, you develop them. But damn, if they're good and you don't have the NIL money to keep them, they're going to leave in this environment. I mean, they're not going to just stick around because they like Fat Sal's. They're going to leave.
Well, you cannot be a farm system for your main rival. That's certainly an issue. Certainly an issue that was eminently preventable if UCLA had decided to behave like a big boy and retain its defensive coordinator. But my contention would be local guys who pick UCLA, they have a barrier to going to another school that requires a lot of NIL money because they have their family around. They have their family coming to games and all that kind of stuff. Like, it is a soft factor, but it's one that needs to be acknowledged. Yes, if they end up, if you get a quarterback from local and he ends up being a Heisman contender, you're probably going to have to come up with some money to retain him. But guess what? If you have a local guy who's a Heisman contender, even at UCLA, you might be able to come up with the NIL money to retain him. This is the part where, like, you can't create something from nothing. And trying to do it with a bunch of one-year rentals in the transfer portal requires such a built-in apparatus that UCLA is not going to have. And this is all I'm saying, again, is that they need to jettison the entire coaching staff and get a new coach in there. Because the only way any of this happens is with any energy whatsoever. Because they need somebody with energy who's going to build up an initial base of funds, recruit locally, get some guys in there that have familial support and they want to be here and that whole thing, develop them, and your funds will start building because the guys are good and they're local. There's a lot of obvious things here that you can't do it with a failed coach. The right time to fire a failed coach is always right now or yesterday, and they didn't do it. So what we're doing we're analyzing a broken thing that's not going to be fixed.
So let's just finish that off. If we're thinking about, we said it would be unusual if they got in spring a really high impact transfer. Given how this roster looks, I'm talking now just next season. You were talking really big picture, long term. The offense should probably be a little bit better. Mm. There are skill position guys that are coming returning. You would think Ethan Garbers will be better. I would have to think T.J. Harden is going to be better. If J. Michael Sturdivant and Kyle Ford, they have a good receiver group.
Be better on offense.
Will be better on offense. Better marginally because it's still about the offensive line. So just leave that, have a pin in that. And then defensive line, to me, they are not going to be as good because no matter what, you're not replacing that production at edge. But even to have a chance to be okay, to me, it's all about Jay Tuia. If Jay Tuia skips town, they are hurting because now all the dominoes fall. You don't have anyone to anchor that inside. Without anchoring that inside, now the real impact of not having a great pass rush, it just, no matter who your linebackers are, they're on their heels. The secondary, you know, the quarterback's going to pick them apart. That's key. They have a chance not to be as good as they were last year. They have a chance to just be in a decent defense, I think, and you can literally hang it on one guy, and that's Jay Tuia. Getting back to offense, and I'm gonna lower the bar. If they could just get a left tackle, somehow, some way, there's, you know, the Jim Harbaugh leaves. There's a 4-star Michigan left tackle who decides he wants to come back home. You know, whatever. If they could just get a left tackle, then that offense, I think, would really have a chance to be pretty good. And then you've got to put all that up against what did 24/7 rate UCLA's schedule, the fifth toughest in the country.
Yep.
So that's where that all stands. Those are things to watch. I think it's definitely Jay Tawia. If somehow they could pull out a tackle, I'd give him a decent chance to be pretty good against the fifth toughest schedule in the country.
Yeah, I think the defense is going to be bad. I mean, I think it's going to be
even with Jay Tawia.
Yeah, it's going to be bad. Yeah, it's going to be bad. Darius Musau leaving, Femi Oladejo taking over for him. I like Femi. I think he's a bit part. I don't think he's a starter. Not at that position, at least. I think they're going to take a major step back in the secondary, and not having a base pass rush is going to kill them.
Yeah.
Just kill them.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. But imagine with all of that if they lose Jay Tuia.
Yeah, it'll be worse. But it's going to be bad anyway.
Okay.
So, yeah. Whatever. It's the situation. Everyone knows it is.
But with all the transfers, I thought we just had to go through it.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Okay.
We got to do it.
Okay, good.
We got to do it.
I'm glad you're happy.
Yeah, I love talking about UCLA football.
Yeah,
me too. It makes me...
Let's keep going. It
fills me with joy.
Oh, wait. Times. You've got something to do. Okay.
We both have something to do, which is finish this podcast. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm David Woods. He's Tracy Pearson. And we'll talk to you again next time.
See y'all.
Hello, everyone. It's Michael Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.